I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres sounded the alarm at a press conference at the opening of the Madrid Climate Summit on Sunday.
Climate change has become a dramatic threat to human health and to human security. In short, climate change is no longer a long-term problem. We are confronted now with a global climate crisis. And the point of no return is no longer over the horizon. It is in sight and hurtling towards us. However, my message here today is one of hope, not of despair. Our war against nature must stop, and we know that that is possible. The scientific community has provided us with a roadmap to achieve this.
Guterres reiterated the goals set in Paris in 2015 to reduce greenhouse gas emissions as we experience more extreme weather and rising temperatures around the world that are affecting humans and animals and our environment. Last month, the Trump administration formally notified the UN that the U.S. is withdrawing from the Paris Agreement on climate change. The U.S., China, and India are the largest CO2 emitters in the world. Joining us is Michael Mann, and he's a professor of atmospheric science and director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. He's the author of a number of books, including Dire Predictions, Understanding Climate Change, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, and The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. He joins us from the studios of Penn State University. And Michael Mann, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Good to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. And do you share the Secretary General's sort of mixed response, both that we are facing a crisis, but we cannot give up hope?
Yeah, I thought it was actually pitch perfect. We are dealing with an urgent problem now in climate change. This isn't a far off problem impacting just polar bears in the Arctic. We are seeing devastating impacts of climate change now play out in real time where we live. And that is the point. There is great urgency in acting, but the other side of it is that while there's urgency, there's also agency. As he pointed out, there is a roadmap that we have provided, the scientific community has provided, for how we can limit warming to keep it under those levels of warming that commit us to truly dangerous and irreversible impacts on the climate. There is still a path forward to doing that, and that's important.
It is important. I do want to get to the roadmap, but last week there was another report from the UN, their emissions gap report, basically saying that we're not going to meet the goal set at Paris in 2015. In fact, predicting that by the end of the century there could be global temperature rises as much as 3.9 Celsius. That's about 7 degrees Fahrenheit. I found that very worrisome.
Yeah, that's true. The scenario they're describing there is what you might call a business-as-usual scenario. It's a scenario where we completely fail to act. And that is extremely unlikely because we are already seeing action. We're just not seeing the level of action that's necessary, as you just said. We're unlikely to meet our Paris commitments. We'll come close to them. And that's the good news. We brought emissions to a peak where they were flat for several years, which signaled that maybe we were ready to come down the other side of that curve and bring our emissions down. Unfortunately, a few years ago, we elected a president in Donald Trump who dismisses climate change as a hoax and threatened to pull out of the Paris Accord. Well, that, of course, provided cover for other countries or provided an excuse for them not doing their own due diligence. And since then, we've seen China start to build more coal-fired power plants. Their emissions have ticked up and global emissions as a result have ticked up. So that's the bad news. The good news is that it's not too late to bring them down, to keep warming below 1.5 Celsius, that's about 3 degrees Fahrenheit, where we truly, where we do indeed commit to the worst impacts of climate change. But it's an even steeper downhill, ride down that curve we have to take now because of the fail to act.
How wide is that then window of action that you're talking about?
Well, we need to bring our emissions down globally by more than 7% a year for the next 10 years and then continue to bring them down, achieving what we call carbon neutrality, where there's no net adding of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere by the middle of the century. That's the roadmap that currently exists. And again, it's we're talking about a precipitous decline. We really have to bring those emissions down sharply now. And that's going to require monumental action by all of the nations of the world. And that's what makes this current conference, COP25, the conference in Madrid, so important. This may be a last-ditch opportunity for us to actually meet those obligations that keep us below catastrophic warming.
I'm trying to imagine what a 7% then cut in global emissions would mean to the world.
Well, you know, the good news is that we actually have the solution in the form of renewable energy. We're just not incentivizing it. Right now, we continue to provide subsidies to the fossil fuel industry. We're literally incentivizing the form of energy production, fossil fuel burning, that is destroying the planet and not providing equal incentives to renewable energy. So, there are various ways to do that, to level the playing field so renewable energy, which isn't generating carbon pollution, can compete fairly in the energy marketplace. One way to do that is to put a price on carbon. The other way to do that is to explicitly provide subsidies for renewable energy, for electrification. Arguably, in fact, I would argue we need to be doing both. Now, we have two main lever arms. At this point, we've got to be using them both if we're going to achieve those, again, those substantial reductions that are necessary in our carbon emissions.
You're describing a political solution then.
That's right. There are no physical limits here. There's nothing about the physics of the climate system, about our understanding of the science of climate change, which says we can't limit warming below catastrophic levels. The only obstacles right now are political ones, and those can be overcome.
Well, I'm interested in, and you mentioned renewables, but is part of the solution, or maybe even the solution, then a technological one?
Well, you know, you often hear that. You hear the, you know, I would argue that it's almost another form of denial to say that, well, let's just allow the market to innovate and it'll find solutions. We have the solution right now. It's called renewable energy. It's called wind, solar, geothermal. We just need to provide the economic incentives to allow renewable energy to compete fairly in the marketplace. We have the solution. We don't need a miracle, despite what Bill Gates might say. We don't need a miracle. The miracle's already there. It's the sun, it's the wind, and all of these other forms of renewable energy.
Do you think, and we'll be getting to this when our second guest joins our conversation, but do you think that we have, in a sense, sort of turned the page on climate denialism?
I think so. I think the hard denial, as it were, we've moved beyond that simply because it's impossible for somebody with a straight face to deny that climate change is happening when people can see it with their own two eyes. We're seeing the devastating impacts of climate change play out in the form of unprecedented wildfires and superstorms and droughts and floods and heat waves. So what we're seeing instead by the forces of inaction, there's still a very powerful vested interest, the fossil fuel industry, that doesn't want to see us move on. And so they're coming up sort of with new excuses for why we don't need to tackle this problem. It's in some ways more insidious. It's the subject of my next book, Winning the Climate War, which is about this sort of new form of delay and inaction where, it's just a matter of individuals. We don't need policies. We don't need to put a price on carbon. We just need individuals to be more responsible. That's one line of argumentation they're using. That's one sort of front in this war on climate action. But there are others, doom and gloom, sort of fomenting despair because it leads us down the same path of inaction as outright denial. We have to be aware of efforts to make us believe that it's too late to do anything about it because that's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Let me pick up on both of those things and the idea that individuals have a responsibility to do things that are going to help the environment and reduce climate change. I mean, I feel like as a responsible human being, we should all be doing something.
Absolutely. And there's a fallacy that has been sort of promoted that it's one or the other. And it isn't. It's both. Obviously, there are lots of things that we can do in our everyday lives make us feel better. They save us money. They make us healthier. They reduce our environmental and carbon footprint. Why wouldn't we do all those things? Right. Of course we should do them. But at the same time, not everybody will do that just because it's the right thing to do. So we do need incentives. Economists understand if you want to see a large-scale shift in behavior, you need to incentivize it in the marketplace. And that's where things like price on carbon, incentives for renewable energy, that's where policy comes in. And so we need individual action, but we need systemic action. And systemic action requires collective action. It requires us going out and voting and holding our policymakers accountable for representing our interests rather than the fossil fuel interests who too often fund their campaigns and maintain a stranglehold on our politics.
How is doomsdayism, people that, look at some of this of what we've been talking about and just feel like, we are doomed. How is that like denialism?
Yeah. And it's important for us to understand, where that comes from and to do empathetic to those who are in despair, because it's easy to understand this feeling of powerlessness that we have in the face of overwhelming forces, fossil fuel interests and the politicians in their pay who have done everything they can to block progress on this issue. So it's understandable. But what people have to realize is or what they have to make sure is that they don't play into the agenda of the fossil fuel interests who want to turn that into inaction. They want to convince you that it's too late to do anything, because if you truly believe it's too late to do anything, then why bother? Then why vote? Then why take action to help tackle this problem? So we need to make it clear that, again, at the risk of repeating myself, there is urgency, but there is also agency. We have the ability to make this change.
About a minute before our first break, I've heard young people say, I don't want to have children because I worry about the world that they're going to inherit.
Well, I find that sad, of course, because I want to see us continue to flourish on this planet. I'm a big fan of humankind. I'm one myself.
Me too.
But we need to live sustainably on this planet. And there's a way forward where we can continue to exist, but we can do so sustainably. That's the challenge.
And that is Michael Mann. He's a professor of atmospheric science, a director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center, and one of the early scientists who worried about and saw evidence of climate change, of global warming. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll be talking about a public opinion and climate change. You can join us. Questions or comments, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Again, taking a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Much more to talk about, including how Americans feel about climate change. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and we've been talking about climate change and the fact that the world is falling short, reducing emissions that are causing rising global temperatures. And again, Michael Mann joining us from the studios of Penn State University, where he is director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. Also joining us is Edward Maybach, and we do want to talk about the fact that public opinion and public plays an important role in understanding and addressing the problems of climate change. He's a professor and director of the George Mason University Center for Climate Change Communication. Edward Maybach, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
So where does public opinion stand when it comes to just understanding whether or not we are facing the effects of climate change?
Yeah, the public is in a really exciting moment. We are waking up to the reality of climate change, it wasn't that long ago that most of us saw climate change as a distant problem. While most Americans have accepted the reality of climate change for a long time, we saw it as a problem that was distant in time, sometime off in the future, not today, distant in space, somewhere else, maybe a country that we can't even find on the map, not here, not my community, and fundamentally distant in species. Polar bear, sure, but people, not so much. But over the past 5 years, Americans have really come to better understand that actually climate change is a here and now us problem. And, you know, as we have woken up to the problem, we have become increasingly more concerned and increasingly more insistent on seeing real solutions being brought to the table.
My good man, let me get a response from you. And is it that we are literally experiencing things like the fires in California or the floods or extreme weather patterns, hurricanes of, you know, unbelievable force? Has that sort of woken us up to the impact of climate change?
It has, and it's a real pleasure to be here with my good friend Ed Maybach. Ed has really been doing some of the most important work in when it comes to sort of public opinion and thinking on this issue. And indeed, I believe Ed's work and others' work demonstrates that, you know, what's actually playing out in real time, the same climate caused disasters that we see on our television screens and our newspaper headlines and our social media feeds, everyone else is seeing that. People are seeing this problem with their own two eyes. And that, along with a number of developments, I think, the children's climate movement, which has really galvanized attention globally for this issue, a shift that's underway in our politics, the Green New Deal, which has sort of moved the window of discourse about climate change back where it belongs. You know, I think all these things have come together in, if you'll forgive the expression, a sort of perfect storm to create a real opportunity going into this next election for meaningful progress here in the United States.
Edward, is the American public, are they more likely to believe scientists now than they used to?
They've always been willing to believe scientists. There was a brief dip in that at one point, but by and large, scientists are among the most trusted people in our society. The problem is, no offense to my dear friend Michael Mann, the problem is that most of us don't know any of them. We don't know Michael by name. When other people conduct surveys and they interrupt us at dinner time and they ask us if we can name a living scientist, only one out of three of us will even try to answer that question.
Oh, wow.
And most of us who do try, we name long dead scientists. So it's great that we trust our scientists. It would be better if we knew them. We do a lot of work at my center with TV weathercasters, because TV weathercasters are actually the scientists that most people feel they do know. And weathercasters, like the public, actually have really leaned in on this issue over the past 5 years, talking about helping their viewers understand, as Michael was suggesting, that climate change is here. It's in our backyard now. And that has absolutely helped us better understand climate change is our problem, not somebody else's.
Michael, let me go back to you, just toggling back and forth between the two of you. How do you think, though, broadly speaking, the media, such as it is, that the media has educated the public about climate change?
Well, you know, I think there is a sea change underway, and in substantial part due to the work by Ed and his colleagues of helping educate not just weather broadcasters, but also people in the media more generally, journalists, bringing journalists together with scientists so that they can understand each other's language. And I think that those efforts have really started to bear fruit. We have seen a shift in the way, at least in my perception, the way that the media now covers this issue. There's very little of what we used to call the false balance, where, you know, if you have a climate scientist on the one hand, you need to have an industry-funded climate change denier up there at the same time, treating this as a crossfire-like debate, when in fact the overwhelming majority, and in fact in one recent study, literally 100% of the scientists in the field who are publishing are now on record. Climate change is real. It's human-caused. Bad things are happening because of it. we can still do something about it. And I've seen a far more favorable framing of this issue. I myself do a lot of media these days. I was on MSNBC twice within the last 4 days,
wow,
talking about the climate crisis. So there's a real appetite in the mainstream media for talking about this. Not enough, but a whole lot better than where things were a few years ago. And I'm sure Ed can shed some additional light on that.
Well, and let me just do a confession here. I would say 15, 20 years ago, Michael Mann, we had those kinds of debates on radio times. But over
right.
time, we just realized that it was a faux argument and not
yeah.
really worth having. Let me yeah. go back to you, Edward. And as Michael Mann says, and as your research found, the people, Americans, believe this is a human caused problem. Do Americans, again, broadly speaking, feel like there is a human involved solution?
So this is the really interesting thing about how we feel about climate change. While let's just say, give or take, 7 out of 10 of us Americans are worried about climate change, mm-hmm. and let's just say 7 out of 10 of us would like to see a whole portfolio of solutions rolled out. Actually, even more of us, more like 8 out of 10 or 9 out of 10, depending on the questions we ask, we support clean energy. Even if we don't believe the climate is changing, or even if we don't believe it's human activity that is causing the climate to change. Americans are wildly enthusiastic about clean energy. We see it as the better form of energy because we see it as a cleaner form of energy, a healthier form of energy. And so even friends of mine, people I've met who vehemently do not believe that human-caused climate change is a reality, they still believe that a clean energy future is a better future for us, for our children, for our nation, for the world. So the short answer to your question is, yeah, absolutely. Americans are incredibly supportive of accelerating the transition to a clean energy economy.
Are they willing? Are they? I'm talking about, like, I'm not an American, but are we willing to pay more to change our lifestyle, to do things that really would be different than what we're doing now?
That would have been exactly the right question to ask 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. It probably would have been exactly the right question to ask 5 years ago. I don't think it's a fair question today, and I'll tell you why. Today, the price of clean energy has come down so dramatically that in many states in the union, it's actually cheaper to shut down the fossil fuel burning power plants and erect clean energy plants, be that wind or solar. So the economics of clean energy have changed so dramatically that we no longer have to be willing to accept the trade-off of higher prices to get better energy. In fact, we can have better energy and lower prices. I just caught the last part of your conversation with Michael in the last segment, and in which he was talking about how industry is systematically working very hard. The fossil fuel industry is working very hard to block this transition because they don't want it, because that means we won't buy their product anymore. But if it weren't for that interference in our, you know, in our policy process and in our utilities, America would be really moving forward aggressively to embrace a clean energy future.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Edward Maybach, and he's a professor and director of George Mason University's Center for Climate Change Communication. Also with us, Michael Mann, a professor of atmospheric science, director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center, talking about climate change, public opinion, and what to do about it. Again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Michael, here's an email from Dave who says, what do you say to people that are not skeptical of climate change, but are skeptical of the proposed solutions that may place us at an economic and political disadvantage? The people that really are saying it's, you know, don't, in a sense, don't believe your lying eyes, that this is not happening. What do you do about that?
Yeah, so we're talking about people who accept that that the problem is real, but they're just they don't accept that the solutions are to stop burning fossil fuels.
Right.
Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so what I would say is that that you know, represents progress at some level. Because as Ed said, if you really have that conversation about the solutions, it's actually a very positive conversation. It's very empowering, the idea that we have you know, the ability to tap into the sun and the wind and all these natural resources that are just intrinsically cleaner and get the energy we need. Let's have that conversation. I'm confident that if that were the conversation we were having, we'd be much further along. If we hadn't indeed been stymied by decades of denial and anti sort of renewable energy propaganda by fossil fuel interests and those advocating for them, if we hadn't been subjected to that for decades, we would be so much further down the road towards solutions here. So, yeah, let's have that conversation. We can actually, as Ed alluded to, renewable energy will potentially become cheaper than fossil fuel energy. There is a huge sort of right now we're still sort of on that you know, that ramping up of economies of scale as we deploy it at larger scale, as we continue to do research and development and refine the technology, it's only becoming better and cheaper. And we're already, as Ed alluded to, close to grid parity. If we got rid of those subsidies, both explicit and implicit subsidies for fossil fuels, leveled the playing field, then, you know, renewable energy would be beating the fossil fuel industry's clock. The only reason that's not happening right now is because the fossil fuel industry and politicians doing their bidding have their thumbs on the scales right now. That's what has to change. And, of course, the way we can change that is by electing more enlightened leaders.
Edward, I'm thinking about climate change communication, that's what your center does. You reference polar bears, and I think anyone that sees a polar bear, you know, alone on a drifting piece of ice is worried. But does scaring people, does that is that a way to get action?
Yeah, as it turns out, actually, it helps to be worried. So fear does help. But fear alone is not the solution. People have to also feel a sense of urgency. They have to realize we need action today. But more than anything, they need to feel a sense of agency, meaning there are things that we can do. There are real solutions at hand that we can put in place today, and that we, the people, have the right to demand those solutions. So we show very clearly in our research that people who feel worried and people who feel hopeful, they believe that there are actions that can be taken, those are the people who are rolling up their sleeves and getting involved and helping to bring about those solutions. And the most important way that Americans can help to bring about solutions is to contact their elected representatives on Capitol Hill, in their state house, in their city hall or county council. Those are the people who we put in office to do our bidding. And if they don't know that this is the bidding we want them to do, they have other things that might seem more pressing to them.
Michael, you mentioned the fact that the Trump administration wants to pull out of the, and in fact, officially notified the United Nations that the U.S. is going to withdraw from the Paris Agreement on climate change. But as we know, even those countries who are still part of this agreement, they have not, as I understand it, haven't met the goals that were set in 2015.
Yeah, and of course, the one way we can block that effort by Trump is to not reelect him. And so keep that in mind. The 2020 presidential election couldn't be more important when it comes to the issue of climate change. Now, it is true, as you allude to, that a number of countries are not going to meet their Paris obligations, their Paris commitments. But most are going to come pretty close. And this is remarkable. The U.S. is going to come very close to meeting its obligations, even with a president who denies climate change, who has tried to dismantle the climate policies put in place by the previous administration that helped us make the gains that we've made. Even with that opposition from our chief executive and a lack of support for climate legislation by a split Congress, we're seeing enough action at the local level, at the state level, at groups of states banding together. Pennsylvania has become part of REGI now, which is a regional consortium of mid-Atlantic and northeastern states that all support incentives for renewable energy and a price on carbon. Because of all those efforts and the efforts by many of our countries, which are still many of our companies and corporations.
It's confusing sometimes, isn't it?
It can be, that are still committed to Paris. Because of that, we're going to come very close, if not actually indeed meet our Paris obligations. That's the good news. The bad news is meeting our Paris obligations alone doesn't get us to where we need to be. It gets us less than halfway to the targets that we need to hit if we're going to keep warming below that catastrophic 1.5 degrees Celsius, 3 degrees Fahrenheit warming of the globe. If we're going to do that, we need to see a substantial ratcheting up of commitments from all the countries of the world. That's what makes this current climate of the Conference of the Parties, COP25 climate conference in Madrid, so important. This may be a last-ditch opportunity for us to ratchet up those obligations in time to avert catastrophic warming of the planet.
Edward, final question to you. Do you see a generational divide when it comes to understanding about climate change?
Yeah, there's a very that is the $64,000 question. Oh. I happen to be a Democrat. I have been one my whole life. I have children. I hope to have grandchildren someday. There's just not a whole lot of generational difference on the Democratic side, but there's a significant and growing generational difference on the Republican side. So while grandparents and parents of Republican parents and grandparents tend to be still pretty much on the fence about this issue, their children and grandchildren are not. They are increasingly realizing that we've been fed a bill of goods that is not in our best interest. It's not in our country's best interest or our world's best interest. It's only in the fossil fuel industry's best interest. So young Republicans, actually, it seems like they're going to be the ones who really, I think, turn America on this issue and finally get us pointed in the right direction.
Well, Edward Maybeck, much more to talk about. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And he's a professor at George Mason University, where he directs the Center for Climate Change Communication. Michael Mann staying with us for the rest of the hour. Much more to talk about. He's a professor of atmospheric science, director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center, joining us from the studios of Penn State University. And after this short break, we'll talk about how Climate Gate and Russia Gate have something in common. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Michael Mann about climate change. Michael, we've got a bunch of people that have questions for you, but I want to read something that you wrote in Time magazine recently. 10 years ago, hackers with links to Russia and WikiLeaks broke into an email server in the UK and released stolen emails in a massive, carefully orchestrated disinformation campaign designed to impact the upcoming Copenhagen Climate Summit of December 2009. So it was literally 10 years ago.
That's right.
This became known as ClimateGate. What I found so interesting in your piece in the New York Times, in Time magazine, was that that was really kind of a precursor for the Russiagate scandal of 2016.
Indeed it was. And if you think back to that, that event 10 years ago where, hackers connected to various organizations, conservative organizations, right-wing groups that have been trying to undermine public faith in the science of climate change, literally stealing people's emails and misrepresenting their contents. When you look at who was involved, Russia was involved. Russia is implicated as having been helping distribute those emails. WikiLeaks was also involved in the effort to distribute the the emails, and this was clearly an effort to block progress on climate by trying to create confusion and doubt in the lead up to this very important Copenhagen climate conference, which was the first opportunity in years for meaningful progress on climate. And the parallels with Russiagate are quite remarkable.
Yeah.
Stolen emails used to influence an important international event or election. Russia and WikiLeaks implicated. And ultimately, what was Russiagate about? Rachel Maddow has a new book out,
yes.
Where she actually makes a pretty convincing case, and she's made this case before on her show. In fact, a couple years ago, she was already starting to connect the dots. If you look at Russiagate, what this really appears to have been about was the fact that Rosneft, the Russian state oil company, and ExxonMobil, the world's largest fossil fuel company, had a joint venture, had an agreement worth $500 billion to tap into the reserves, oil reserves in Siberia, in Russia. And that $500 billion deal was stymied because of sanctions against Russia due to their actions in Ukraine. What was the first thing
that happened? Full circle, right?
Absolutely. And what happened at the Republican convention, they tried to remove the language supporting those sanctions from the Republican platform. Who does Donald Trump appoint as Secretary of State in charge of? Rex Tillerson, former CEO of ExxonMobil. Russiagate apparently was really about fossil fuels. And the MO was the same MO used to stymie progress 10 years ago when it came to the Copenhagen summit. And so as we continue to connect the dots here, I think it's starting to emerge fairly clear that ClimateGate was probably a test run for what Russia did in the last presidential election and what they're continuing to do now.
Wow. Well, we're going to have to follow up on that at some later date. Let me get to some of the emails here. Sheila says, what behavior changes can individuals make that will be collectively make a difference in emissions? And this is back to literally what an individual can do.
Yeah, well, I would say the most important thing an individual can do is vote. And as Ed Maybach said, and contact your elected representatives. Make sure that they understand how important this issue is to you as a voter and vote in elections. Because if we don't vote for politicians willing to do something about this problem, we're going to continue to get politicians hand-selected by the fossil fuel industry who are doing everything they can do to block progress. But, you know, when it comes to our individual everyday actions, you know, there's no magic bullet. It really comes down to your particular lifestyle. If you feel comfortable, if you're, you know, currently a meat eater and you feel like you can make a go of not eating beef or maybe not eating meat at all, becoming a pescatarian or a vegetarian or a vegan, we all have to decide sort of our comfort level. But changing our diet can make a difference here. I've become a pescatarian along with my daughter, and for many reasons, for ethical reasons, but also because of the environmental footprint of eating meat. But I don't, you know, I don't feel it's appropriate to try to mandate to police other people's lifestyles. Make the shifts in your own lifestyle that work for you, that are consistent with your values and with the constraints on your life. And that comes to transportation. If you can get away with, public transportation rather than driving your own vehicle, if you can afford a, you know, an electric vehicle or a plug-in hybrid, it's, you know, we, there are lots of little things that we can do, steps, sometimes even baby steps that take us in the right direction. And sometimes it's as important to just take some of those initial steps because it leads us down a path of greater and greater engagement.
Here's an email from David who says, doesn't methane from raising animals for food break down the climate much more quickly than CO2?
Methane is a potent greenhouse gas. It's considerably more potent on shorter time scales than CO2. On longer time scales, if we're looking a century or more out, it's really all about the CO2. But if we're talking about the sort of warming over the next decade or two, methane is an important player. Now, methane is rising in substantial part, we think, because of natural gas drilling, hydraulic fracturing. But there is also a contribution from livestock. That's one of the reasons that, you know, if you stop eating beef and you stop eating meat, you're sort of helping out with that problem. But, you know, agriculture and livestock and food as a sector are only about 14 or so percent of our total carbon emissions. And beef, for example, is only in the neighborhood of like 7 or 8% of our total greenhouse gas emissions. So it's not the lion's share. The lion's share of our carbon emissions from the burning of fossil fuels for energy and transportation, and we have to be focused on that while recognizing that there are other things that we can do to diminish our carbon footprint.
Nancy wonders, why isn't this the main issue in the Democratic debates? It was a couple of questions, I think, a couple of debates ago, but I think even in 2016, it rarely or barely ever came up. Do you think we're in a different place now?
Yeah, we've seen a greater prominence of climate. In fact, there were two forums, one held by MSNBC, another by CNN, specifically just for climate. That's a good step, but it needs to be integrated. You know, it shouldn't be treated as a niche issue that has its own debate. It needs to be integrated because it impacts every one of the other challenges that we face. And that's where I think there remains to be quite a bit of progress in how we frame this in our presidential debates and even in the media coverage. Connecting those dots, when people realize that national security is a climate issue,
Well, the military knows that, right?
Absolutely. They recognize climate change is the greatest security threat we face in the decades ahead because it's what they call a threat multiplier. It takes existing tensions and exacerbates them. I mean, look at ISIS. ISIS was born within an environment in Syria where they were suffering from an unprecedented drought that forced rural farmers into the cities where they were competing for food and water and space with the people who already lived there, creating conflict, creating competition and conflict in that atmosphere of conflict. Provided a perfect recruiting tool for a terrorist organization we call ISIS to recruit people to their cause. There was a climate connection there. And so when people say that we need to focus on the issues that really matter, like terrorism, and not be distracted by other issues like climate change, that's a fallacy. These things are intimately connected.
What do you think about nuclear energy as a way of replacing energy driven by fossil fuels?
Well, you know, I would say that all options should be on the table. Let's have that conversation. I would be delighted if in Congress right now we were debating climate solutions rather than is climate change even real. So we need to get on from the fake debate of whether we have a problem to the worthy debate of how we solve it. And, you know, I think discussions of nuclear energy, the role of nuclear energy should be on the table. All options should be on the table. That doesn't mean that we don't end up taking them back off the table, which is to say if we look at the total environmental impacts of all of these choices. Well, nuclear energy comes with its own environmental threats. We know that. It also comes with proliferation issues that we need to worry about. And here's the kicker. Renewable energy nuclear energy requires massive government funding and infrastructure. So if you're a free market person, if you're a conservative who believes we should allow the market to determine the winners and losers, well, then nuclear energy is likely to be one of the losers because it can't compete without massive government investment. That's important to understand. And it's a long-term investment. It takes more than 50 years for a conventional nuclear power plant to pay off. And so we're locking in infrastructure that commits us to, you know, potentially dangerous, when it comes, again, to proliferation and nuclear radiation, potentially dangerous means of energy production when a better solution, renewable energy, is available. We have to think about that.
Hmm. Dana wonders, can your guest comment on the backlash against Greta Thunberg's climate advocacy? Dana says some of it was pretty vehement. It was weird. And I would just add, I thought it was disturbing and frankly frightening. But what did you make of that? Here's this, you know, young teenager who is concerned about climate change.
Yeah. And, you know, you have these old white men on Fox News attacking a little girl. That's not a good look. Climate change deniers. It's not a good look. And it, to me, it exposed the true face of climate change denial. The fact that they would come down on somebody like Greta Thunberg, who is doing this out of her which she feels a personal obligation. She has nothing to gain personally from this. She's doing this because she feels it's right, and she has empowered an entire generation to focus on this issue. She's done so much good for all of us and for our planet, and the fact that conservative media outlets are fomenting hatred of her, and that's where it comes from. Keep in mind, when you see all those nasty tweets on Twitter and social media posts, that's being orchestrated at the very top. That's red meat that's being thrown out to the conservative base by the Fox Newses of the world and the Wall Street Journal editorial pages of the news. There's a concerted effort by conservative media to foment that hate because they are so threatened. They are so threatened by a 16-year-old girl.
Hmm. Paul says energy is one thing. What are you going to replace plastic with?
Oh, you know, me personally, that's above
or
my
maybe
pay grade.
All of us, yes.
You know, it gets to an important question, which is climate change is just sort of one dimension of this multidimensional problem that we face, which is environmental sustainability. And so it's easy for us to just focus on one part of the problem, like climate change, without realizing that there are other problems associated with, you know, our continued dependence on single-use plastic and ocean pollution, one of the other great environmental crises that we face today. So climate change is just part of the problem. We need to be rethinking our entire environmental footprint and, you know, one step at a time. We need to start moving in the right direction. We need to get rid of the obstacles that are blocking progress. And the best way to do that right now here in the United States is turning out to vote in the 2020 presidential election and voting all the way down the ticket, not just for a president, but all the way down to dog catcher. Who's the best person when it comes to tackling the crises we face? The crises we face, including, of course, climate change.
A question from Kate. Then I want to tack on a science question for you, Michael Mann. Kate says, are the floods, fires, and earthquakes we've been experiencing just a new normal? My question to you is, why 1 or maybe 2, maybe 3 degrees of global temperature rise, why does that have such a catastrophic effect on things like weather?
Yeah, and earthquakes aren't part of it. That's a natural geophysical phenomenon. But wildfires and heat waves and floods and superstorms are being made worse by climate change. There's no question about that. And even the modest warming that we've seen so far, just a little over 1 degree Celsius, a little less than 2 degrees Fahrenheit, has been enough to lead to substantial melting of ice around the world, shifts in the position of drought zones and rainfall bands, and very substantial increases in the incidence of extreme weather events. And you can ask, well, how can a few degrees do something like that? Well, keep in mind, this is a balanced system. It's a system that has been in balance for thousands of years, or largely so. And we've caused this dramatic imbalance. It's similar to a fever, right? We are a balanced system. Our bodies work very hard to maintain our temperature close to 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit because all of the processes are predicated on our temperature being close to that value. Warm that up a few degrees. Warm that up 5 degrees, and you face prospects of death. What we're doing is we're causing a planetary fever that threatens all of us.
Almost out of time here. Where does your optimism come from?
My optimism comes from the fact that we've risen to the challenge as a species before. We've tackled other major environmental problems like ozone depletion, acid rain. But more than anything else, it's the way that our young people have re-seized the public conversation. They've recentered this discussion where it needs to be. It's about our obligation, our ethical obligation to future generations not to destroy this planet. We still have an opportunity to make sure that that is not our legacy, that our ancestors will look back and recognize that when we we're at the precipice, we looked into the abyss, we took the actions necessary to avert catastrophe. That can still be our legacy.
Well, we always like to end on a positive note. Michael Mann, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. And again, professor of atmospheric science, director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center, joining us from WPSU. That's the studios of Penn State University. His most recent book, The Madhouse Effect, How Climate Change Denial is Threatening Our Planet, Destroying Our Politics, and Driving Us Crazy. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and of course, follow us on Twitter. Charlie Kyer, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moskowain. Thank you so much for joining us.